Hello, this is Chris Yerkes reading you from the July 31st edition of the County Chronicle. We'll start again with the first page stories. Illinois American water rate increase proposed to go in effect in 2025 by Ben Crane. Illinois American Water held a public hearing at the Champaign Public Library last Tuesday to discuss a potential water rate increase, citing needed water and wastewater infrastructure improvements. Illinois American Water filed the rate adjustment request in January and needs to be reviewed and approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission. Public input and involvement are an important part of the process, Rebecca Lossley, president of IAW, said. IAW looks to increase their rates to use $557 million in capital investments. The request for new rates reinforces Illinois American Water's commitment to strategically replacing aging infrastructure, provide reliable service, enhance water quality, and comply with increasing environmental regulations, Lossley went on to explain. Lossley continued, citing Champaign-Urbana's specific planned projects. When asked specifically about improvements to be made in Douglas County, Lossley turned the question over to her media relations specialist. "We have plans to make improvements in Villa Grove," she said. "The exact improvements to be made there are unknown," according to the spokesperson. IAW owns Villa Grove's water service. Members of the public then shared their opinions on the increase, with an AARP spokesperson strongly disagreeing with the prospect of an increase, and Laura Lloyd, who is a member of a consumer watchdog group, slamming the panel. "Let me list a few facts. Illinois America's parent company has raked in nearly $1.8 billion in profits over the last 2 years. Illinois American has won $120 million in rate hikes in less than a decade," Lloyd remarked. Others, who are residents of Champaign-Urbana, also strongly opposed to the rate hikes. Most cited inflation and their current financial situation. The rate adjustment request remains under scrutiny while the Illinois Commerce Commission continues to review and monitor the case. The next article, from Chicken Bristle to Tokyo, Tuscola's Linda Matheny Mulvihill pioneered Olympic gymnastics, by Mark Carroll. This summer's Paris Olympics began July 26th with the U.S. women's Olympic team, led by phenom Simone Biles, favored to win the overall women's gymnastic team title. The U.S. women's gymnastic team has been a powerhouse, placing no worse than third in the last eight Olympics, winning it three times and placing second three times. But it wasn't always so. In fact, not until 1968, during the Mexico City Olympics, did any female U.S. gymnast ever qualify for an Olympic event final. That honor fell to Linda Matheny Mulvihill, who grew up in Tuscola, graduating in 1965 and later attended the University of Illinois. Born August 12, 1947, Linda grew up just outside Tuscola in a rural area referred to as Chicken Bristle. As a young girl, she was drawn to dancing, taught herself cartwheels in the backyard, and begged her mom for dance or acrobatic lessons. Finally, her grandmother agreed to pay the $1 per week tumbling classes with Peg Pettit, held in the basement of Pettit's house just across the street, east of the Douglas County Courthouse. Eventually, Mrs. Pettit realized Linda's burgeoning talent was surpassing her coaching abilities. She recommended Linda take further lessons from Charlie Pond, legendary men's gymnastic coach at the University of Illinois, who also ran a private recreation program. But competitions and lessons at the time cost money and required travel, and money was not abundant at the time in the Matheny household. Unbeknownst to fellow classmates at Tuscola, Linda at the time usually did not eat noon lunch, instead spending the time studying in an empty classroom. Only at her class's 50-year reunion, where she was inducted into the Tuscola High School Hall of Fame, did we learn that she did this to save the lunch money, $2 a week, so she could pay for her competition fees. She also worked at the YMCA to pay for practice costs. During her junior and senior high school years, not having either a license nor a car, Linda relied on Tuscola teachers who lived in Champaign to give her a ride back and forth for lessons, often having to then wait until late in the evening for a ride home with her father, who worked in Champaign. Once in training in Champaign, she evolved from tumbling to ballet and then work on the uneven bars and balance beam. By 1962, Linda was having her first gymnastics competition. Only 2 years later, by 1964, only 16, her junior year in school at Tuscola, she qualified for the women's gymnastic team at the Tokyo Olympics. At the 1964 Games, she distinguished herself by rating second among the six women national gymnasts for all-around performance. In 1965, she enrolled at the University of Illinois, even though there was no women's gymnastic team. Title IX wasn't passed until 1972, and the NCAA didn't add women's gymnastics until 1982. Lacking women's program to train with, Linda trained alongside the men team at the YMCA with her coach and later husband, Dick Mulvihill. Eventually, she found gymnastic college competition around the nation, and compete she did. She is a five-time national elite all-around champion, AAU and USGF, and spent 9 years on the national team, two world championship teams. She earned 7 gold medals at the Pan American Games and was a collegiate all-around champion, as well as USGF Gymnast of the Year. All these accomplishments during college were made when there was no women's team, no scholarships, and no money for travel or entry fees, all of which she paid for herself. Linda then qualified for the 1968 Mexico Olympics. At the 1968 Games, she became the first U.S. women gymnast to qualify for a final event, the balance beam, where she missed out medaling by a mere and controversial 0.025 points. Returning to Champaign, Linda kept training while continuing her college education. She earned both a bachelor's and master's degree from the University of Illinois, earning the prestigious James Scholar Honor despite having to fit 2 gym sessions per day while balancing classes. In 1972, Linda qualified for her final and third consecutive Olympic game, the infamous Munich Games in Germany, marred by the massacre of 11 members of the Israeli Olympic team by members of Palestinian militants Black September. Together with Simone Biles, Muriel Grossman, and Dominique Dawes, Linda is one of the only 4 U.S. female gymnasts to perform in 3 Olympics. She retired after the Games at age 25, moved to Eugene, Oregon, where she and her husband Dick owned and operated the National Academy of Artistic Gymnastics, where they trained many eventual Olympic gymnasts. Dick died in 2013, but the Academy continues, largely under the management of her 3 children, daughter JoJo and sons David and Matthew. She remained active after retirement, refereeing and judging gymnastic competitions, including Olympic Games in 1996 and 2000. She also enjoyed induction into various halls of fame, including the U.S. Gymnast Hall of Fame and the University of Illinois Hall of Fame in 2022. In an NBC special last year featuring Linda, they called her a pioneer of modern women's gymnastics. Before Title IX elevated women's sports to equal status, before the University of Illinois had a women's gymnastic team, before U.S. women's gymnastics became a world-dominating force, before college athletes could earn a name, image, and likeness money, and Olympians get paid, there was Linda. A shy, attractive, and unassuming young wisp of a woman from Chicken Bristle and Tuscola High School grew her love of dancing into a current status as a pioneer in U.S. women's gymnastics. She's a role model among all the role models for anyone with a burning desire to pursue their dream, no matter how many obstacles seem to block the way. We'll move now to the obituaries. Larry Mason Weller, 80, Daytona Beach, Florida, passed away on October 13, 2021. A short memorial service will be held on Saturday, August 3rd at 10 a.m. in the Arcola Township Cemetery. The Edwards Funeral Home is assisting with arrangements. On July 25th, 2024, Bernice Marie Tate Mitchell gained her wings and was called home to heaven. She passed away peacefully at home, being cared for by her children. The world became a brighter, more loving place and kind place on November 26, 29, when God sent Bernice Marie Tate to live on his earth. A celebration of life was held Wednesday, July 31st at Villa Grove United Methodist Church with Pastor Ted Shearer officiating. Joint's funeral home is caring for niece and handling arrangements. Family will greet friends 1 hour before the service at the church. Gail D. Underwood, 80, of Villa Grove, passed away on Thursday evening, July 25th, 2024, at his home. Gail services were held Tuesday, July 30th, at the Hillegas Fritz Schrader Funeral Home, Tuscola, with Reverend Tony Crouch officiating. The visitation was held Monday, July 29th, at the funeral home. Memorials are suggested to the Tuscola First Christian Church Building Fund, 100 East Church Street, Tuscola, Illinois, 61953. Online condolences may be shared via Hillegoth.com. Nell Ruth Sloan of Urbana, formerly of Tuscola, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, July 24, 2024, at her daughter's home. Funeral services were Monday, July 29th, at the Hillegas Schrader Funeral Home, Tuscola. Burial was in the Tuscola Township Cemetery. Carol Ann Allen, 77, of Arcola, passed away at 11:57 a.m. on Sunday, July 21, 2024, at Arcola Health Care Center. Visitation was held Friday, July 26th at the Edwards Funeral Home, Arcola. Funeral services were held Friday at the funeral home. Graveside services were held Friday, July 26th at Sunset Memorial Park in Danville. Janetta Mae Jackson died Monday, July 22nd, 2024 at Tuscola Healthcare Center, Tuscola. A private family service and burial will be held later. In lieu of flowers, donation to the activity fund at Tuscola Healthcare Center or to the Tuscola Public Library would be appreciated. There's an article entitled Grayson's Behavior in Logan County led Superior to ask, how are you still employed with us? Records show deputy who shot Sonia Macy disobeyed orders during high-speed chase, by Beth Hinsdorfer, Capital News, Illinois. Before former Sangamon County Sheriff's Deputy Sean Grayson was accused of shooting Sonia Massey after she called police to investigate a prowler, he had a rocky one-year tenure with the Logan County Sheriff's Department. Personnel records show that Grayson's time there was fraught, though he was not fired by the department. Grayson's file from the Logan County shows he continued a high-speed pursuit of a traffic offender even after his supervisor ordered him to terminate it. A woman filed a complaint claiming Grayson tried to watch as she was strip-searched, and her fiancé, who was in Logan County Jail, claimed Grayson questioned him in front of other inmates as retaliation for his girlfriend's complaint. Logan County Chief Deputy Nathan Miller wrote in November 2022 reports that Grayson needed extensive training after failing to listen to his superiors. He wrote Grayson needed field training along with additional traffic stop training, report writing training, and high-stress decision-making process classes, and needs to read, discuss, and understand issued Logan County Sheriff's Department policies. 7 months on, how are you still employed with this? Miller asked Grayson during a recorded meeting to discuss Grayson's actions. I don't know, Grayson responded. Listen to the audio here. Grayson continued to serve with Logan County Sheriff's Department for 5 more months. Miller told Grayson that these were violations that could lead to his firing. Grayson was still in his probationary period and could be fired at will. The records don't reflect Grayson was disciplined for the incidents, but more training was recommended. Miller did not return a call seeking comment. The open internal investigations were closed when Grayson resigned in April 2023, having not faced any discipline. He started his job at the Sangamon County Sheriff's Department in May 2023. Miller wrote the report nearly 2 years before Grayson shot Massey in the kitchen of her home after she called 911 to report a prowler in the early morning hours of July 6th. Read more. The DOJ confirms it assessing the circumstances of Sonia Massey's shooting. Body cam video shows Sonia Massey's last minute deputy's course description, Sangamon County's deputy charged with first-degree murder. The deputies cleared the outside of the house near Springfield without finding anyone, but went inside to question Massey after finding damage to a vehicle parked outside the house. The encounter turned violent when officers noticed a pot heating liquid on the stove and allowed her to remove it. As the unidentified officer who answered the call with Grayson moved away, Massey, who was black, said, "I rebuke you in the name of Jesus." Grayson, who was white, then threatened to shoot Massey in her face. Moments later, he pulled his 9mm service weapon and fired 3 times, striking Massey once in the face. On the body camera video, Grayson dissuaded his fellow officers from issuing aid to Massey because the wound was fatal. As Massey lay on the kitchen floor, Grayson told the other officer he feared Massey was going to throw the liquid on them and she gave him no choice but to fire. Grayson was fired from Sangamon County and charged with first-degree murder, aggravated battery with a firearm, and official misconduct. He has pleaded not guilty. After Massey's death, questions arose about Grayson's qualification. Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board records show he worked for 6 law enforcement agencies around Central Illinois in 4 years, despite 2 convictions for driving under the influence, a 2-year revocation of his driving privileges, and a general discharge from the military. Grayson had been at the Logan County Sheriff's Department just over for 4 months in 2020 when he continued the pursuit after his superiors ordered him to terminate. He was on probation and working the midnight shift when he attempted to stop a truck that failed to signal a turn, but the driver kept going. Miller noted Grayson pursued the truck through Lincoln at high speeds and without due caution going through intersections. Miller noted Grayson's squad car was traveling faster than 60 miles an hour in a 30-mile-per-hour zone. In the squad car video obtained by Capital News, Illinois, Grayson's supervisor on duty asked if he was chasing the truck on a traffic violation, and Grayson said he is. The supervisor tells Grayson to terminate the pursuit. Instead of slowing down, Grayson turned off his emergency lights and siren and continued at speeds of more than 100 miles an hour to keep the truck in sight, he wrote in his report. The pursuit ended when the deer collided with Grayson's vehicle, rendering it inoperable. During a recorded meeting to discuss Grayson's deficiencies in November 2023, Miller met with Grayson and tried to impress on him the importance of following a chain of command, writing accurate reports, and wearing a uniform while on duty. At one point, Miller pointed out discrepancies to Grayson's report of the high-speed chase. He asked if Grayson was lying because he could not see what prompted to see in the report. That, Miller said, is an official misconduct. At the time, Grayson was on light duty. He was battling colon cancer and undergoing chemotherapy. A month later, after the meeting between Grayson and Miller, the sheriff's department received a complaint that Grayson tried to watch as a female detainee was strip-searched. When contraband was discovered, the woman was sent to a local hospital to have it removed. In a written complaint, she contended he opened the curtain while she was having a pelvic exam to remove drugs. The report was unfounded, but his supervisors recommended that Grayson receive counseling on best practices. 2 weeks later, the woman's fiancé, who was being held in Logan County Jail, filed a complaint stating that Grayson came to the jail questioning him in retaliation. He is angry at her for filing the report and came back here and asked to speak to me in front of all of the other inmates who now know that I talked to detectives, which had possibly put me in danger, the man wrote. Grayson denied any wrongdoing, but the department launched an internal investigation. In March 2023, Grayson pulled up to a dispute at his mother's house in Girard. The police were there, and Grayson pulled his badge, according to the Girard police. The disagreement involved a custody dispute between Grayson's nephews, the report stated. Grayson became angry and began yelling at the Girard police officer who handled the call, then called the police chief and the mayor, according to Girard police reports. In response to an Illinois Freedom of Information Act request, the Logan County Department also released Grayson's hiring packet, discipline, and other personnel records. These records included his application, interview notes, reference checks, and screenshot of his and his girlfriend's social media accounts. Grayson's personnel records included a detailed background check, which revealed potential red flags. The police chief in the city of Auburn, his previous employer, relayed to Logan County that Grayson was very aggressive about making drug arrests and expressed concern that he was too aggressive. The chief further said that Grayson was a bragger who once posted on social media about a drug arrest. The Auburn chief also noted that Grayson struggled with report writing and was not great with evidence, though the chief relayed that Grayson received no write-ups or punishment during his time in Auburn. During his interview with Logan County in March 2022, Grayson answered 195 questions posed by Logan County Sheriff Investigator. Grayson told him, according to the interview notes, that his application he received an honorable discharge from the Army, but Capital News has obtained the discharge paperwork he submitted to the Pawnee Police Department in 2020, which showed he was given a general discharge from Fort Riley, Kansas in 2016, although the exact circumstances of the discharge were not clear. During his interview with Logan County, Grayson said he'd applied for police departments in Champaign and Decatur, as well as the Champaign County Sheriff's Department, but he said he turned them down. Grayson said he made it through the background check, according to interview notes. He also said he applied to the Springfield Police Department in 2019, but didn't go through the process. Massey's family and her attorney, Ben Crump, have said the family was not told that Massey was killed by an officer. They learned that through news reports. Emergency calls placed to the Sangamon County Central Dispatch System obtained by Capital News Illinois shows confusion in the minutes after the shooting. We don't have any information and nobody will tell us anything, which is really fun, the dispatcher told the superintendent during one of the calls. In the minutes after the shooting, a county dispatcher tells Illinois State Police dispatcher they're now saying it's self-inflicted. This week, the U.S. Department of Justice confirmed it is assessing the circumstances surrounding Massey's shooting. Calls for Sangamon County Sheriff Jack Campbell's resignation have grown amid increasing questions surrounding Grayson's hiring. A petition online had 28,000 signatures on Thursday night. The petition questions Campbell's decision to hire Grayson despite his two DUI convictions. On Friday, Campbell asked for an extension in response to a Capital News Illinois request for documents related to hiring practices at the Sheriff's Department. Another article, Bruce Allen Takes Helm of Ag Days, by Tony Hooker. After over two decades of stellar work organizing the Villa Grove Ag Days, Bruce Allen has decided to pass the mantle of leadership on to Donnie Patton. Patton recently sat down with me to discuss his early impressions of the gig and much more. Patton, whose involvement started when he helped out with the Demolition Derby, has most recently served as vice president of the Ag Days Steering Committee, which he now runs as president. I showed up to one meeting and they elected me vice president, Patton recalled with a laugh. As for Allen, Patton is quick to praise him for his assistance in making the transition as smooth as possible, saying that he left Ag Days in great shape and has served as a great mentor as well. The event itself is remaining largely the same, with a few tweaks. We'll have fewer bands on the main stage, but we'll have a family fun night on Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m. We'll have balloon animals and bubbles and other surprises. It's all free to the public, Patton noted. As always, the committee has tried to keep the usual food vendors while adding some new twists. The Moo-mobile from Sydney's Dairy Barn, a deep dish cookie vendor, and Cupcake Notion are three new dessert options that Patton is excited to see coming to town. After years of declining revenue, the steering committee stepped away from hosting the beer tent and hosting bands. And went to JR's, was quick to pick up the opportunity as they'll be hosting Ancient Ways on Saturday night. Patton also related that the Southern Plains Rodeo, which will be in town on Friday night, was working with Ag Days this year to ensure that both events could benefit from each other, and that he was happy to see that the Sundowners Car Club had agreed to host a car show on Saturday. When asked if he had any expectations for entrance in the car show, he was admittedly philosophical. "We don't really have high expectations or low expectations for the number of entrants," he related. "We're just happy to have a car show again." With Connor Family Amusements once again providing the carnival rides and games, Ag Days will once again have the opportunity to purchase wristbands for rides, whether for the afternoon or evening sessions, and Patton noted that he will be selling said wristbands at the Social Oasis on Saturday, July 27th from 4 to 6 p.m. and on Thursday, August 1st from 5 to 7 p.m. Upon assuming the presidency of the Ag Days committee, Donnie had to step away from organizing the Bags tournament, which will be held for the 14th year. Luckily, a familiar face, Travis Parsley, has taken over the event, and there is hope there will be another strong turnout. Other Ag Day staples, including Little Mr. and Little Miss Ag Days, the 3-on-3 basketball tournament, axe throwing, and Kitty straw pile, and Kitty tractor pulls will once again be held, and the JFL cheerleaders will be hosting a dunk tank to raise funds. Thanks to Bruce Allen's help, there haven't been many surprises, but he did say his phone has been busier than usual since he took the lead role and that he was taking the calls he wouldn't normally take. "Every time my phone rings, I answer it, even if it's spam," he noted with a laugh, "and it usually is." How to Get a Wristband for Kids Rides by Tony Hooker. Carla and Bob Westry wanted to help, but they weren't sure how they could. Then they heard of that Jackie Wells, another Villagrovian who's seemingly genetically compelled to do good deeds at the Camargo Township Library, was purchasing wristbands that would allow kiddos to ride the rides at Ag Days. Jackie, as town librarian, knows who could use a little boost in order to be included, and Carla and Bob knew how to make an ask to raise funds. Thus, a partnership which has worked together on other projects in the past was reborn. The Westrays, through their awesome restaurant and the bar JR's, raised enough funds to purchase 115 wristbands, which were then distributed by the library. This year, kids under 12 can register for a lottery of sorts at the library starting on July 29th in order to receive the coveted gifts. As always, with Carla and Jackie, all the rest, it's going to be about the kids and the goal to surpass last year's total. Knowing Bub and Carla and Jackie, that number is sure to grow. Cupcake Notion to Have a Booth at Villa Grove's Ag Days by Tony Hooker. Like many pastry chefs before her, Alyssa Ewing got her start watching her mom. Her mom, who worked as a baker at Sam's Club, would sometimes make cakes, mostly sheet cakes, at home, and Alyssa would always be an eager observer. Fast forward several years, and when her mom decided no longer to continue, she asked her if she wanted her equipment, and Ewing jumped at the chance. Thus, Cupcake Notion, who will have a vendor's table at Ag Days, was born. Unlike her mother, who kept things low-key, Alyssa took all the steps to become a registered business. "I went through the state, I got an EIN tax number, and I made a name for myself and my company," she said. "I made it more official that got what she did, and I started doing fairs and that sort of thing." Another big difference between Ewing and her mother is the type of pastries that she creates. While her mother focused on sheet cakes and the occasional number cake, Alyssa focuses on round cakes along with a number of number cakes, and over time she's branched out and started making cookies, including royal icing and other types of delights. At this point, cupcakes are the main focus as well. Hilariously, when her mom first started baking cakes, she kept Alyssa's involvement to a minimum. She wasn't allowed to stir the batter or make the icing or have anything to do with the process other than one task. "She let me stir the color into the icing," she said with a laugh. Over time, however, her mother relented, and she began to ice the cakes and became more involved in their creations. From those humble beginnings, her passion for baking was kindled. Having been in business for about 18 months, Ewing sees the sky as being the limit for how far she wants to take Cupcake Notion. "I've got my manager's license, and I'm getting my cottage food license, and once I get that, I can go anywhere in the state," she enthused. With the bulk of her business being fairs and festivals, she recently purchased a wine cooler refrigerator to keep her products cool under the hot summer sun, a necessity for central Illinois in the summer months. Although she loves taking her goods to events like Ag Days, the Broomcorn Festival and the Arthur Cheese Festival, and Villa Grove's Christmas tree lighting event in November, her dreams are to open a small shop. One thing that won't change, however, is her love for baking-themed cookies. No matter the time of the season, Ewing has a cookie that fits right in, from red, white, and blue 4th of July cookies to bats and pumpkins for Halloween. Themed cookies are her favorite, and they seem to go over well with her customers as well. I love coming up with seasonal themes, she noted. Whether it's just colored sprinkled or icing, I love to do themes, and people seem to really like them. Ag Day staple set to return as Sundowners host Car Show by Tony Hooker. The Car Show is coming back to Villa Grove Ag Days in 2024 under the auspices of the Champaign-Urbana Sundowners Car Club Limited. Steve Lawson, the webmaster and social media guru for the club, recently agreed to answer five quick questions about the club. 1. How did Sundowners come to be? I've only been a member since about 2017 when I bought a 1995 Mustang after my kids were mostly off the household payroll, as I understand it. Gene Shelton, who's still around, formed the club back in the 1980s, maybe before, to celebrate those who had vintage cars. The Sundowners can probably be called more of a hot rod club than collectors. There's a second club in town that I'm involved with called the Illini Collectors Car Club, which more of these members are involved with some really old cars, such as Model A's, old Packards, many cars from the 30s and older to more current ones like mine. The bottom line is that all old car members of any club have a love for cars. Most appreciate the history of the automobile. For instance, in the 1960s, when I was a kid, my grandfather had a Phillips 66 service station that I worked, and I worked to learn how to take things apart and put stuff back together. I would imagine a lot of our club members have very similar beginnings in collecting cars. 2, how many members are there? We have, I believe, and I'll have to confirm this, 40 to 50 individual members and 30 to 40 sponsors, which include individual memberships. 3, what brings you to Villa Grove? Villa Grove, at least going back to when I first got a car to show, has always been a great show. Lots of cars, lots of activities, and great local support. On my first trip there, the whole park area was filled with cars, as well as some of the side streets. The previous hosts, the Akers family, were great. They reached out to numerous sponsors so that every participant received a door prize, as well as they provided, if I remember correctly, a meal ticket, burger, hot dogs, drink, and chips maybe. The event was well organized and folks had a great time. COVID did a number on all similar gatherings, and I'm not sure exactly what happened other than I think the core group that ran the show decided not to continue. A couple of our members, Tony Martin and Dennis Swan, that live in Villa Grove, let us know that there was a desire to have the show again, but the core group who ran it, but not with the core group that had it before. They came to us, as have several local localities, which run shows each summer, when we were deciding which venues we wanted to take on, already having several we had run for the last few years. And given the history of the show, with the assumption that Tony and Dennis on board, the local support would be good, we chose to help with that show. We do count heavily on local support, businesses to sponsor and give goodies for gift bags, food places that can service the number of people that we bring, and other logistics along those lines. And what we bring is the experience in handling the car portion, registration, more raffle prizes, and the competition, having voting for the top cars and stuff like that. We often have crossover, some between the duties, which help make for a great show. Our hope and expectation is that Villa Grove show can come back and eventually, if not this year, get back to the stature it once was as a must-attend car show for the car owners. 4, what can people expect at a Sundowner car show? Our goal is to provide a great experience for both the participants and the spectators, those who just want to look at the vehicles, and this would include smooth check-in process, ease in good parking directions, consideration for your car in parking and keeping distances, good food options if locale is short of food choices, we're getting food trucks to supplement the local concerns, general happy atmosphere, music, announcements, periodic draws for door prizes, etc., ease in voting and quick turnaround of the voting to give out awards, that's my job, making sure folks know how much of the proceeds each show go to our charity. This year it's the 217 Vets and the 3 Wet Dogs. I'm sure I can think of more, but that's about all the experience each participant and spectator gets from the event. And 5, what's your all-time favorite car? Is it the same one that you show? Good question. I have a 65 Mustang. We had a 67 when I was in high school, which was cool when I got to drive it around. I'm a fan of many of the cars of that era, so that's what I grew up with. That said, I have a 2009 Mustang convertible along with 2 daily drivers, my Ram pickup, and my wife's Palisade. I also marvel at the cars of the Illini Collectors Club members from the turn of the century, i.e. the 1920s era. And that is all we have time for this week. This is Chris Yerke saying goodbye and see you again next week.